Hey, good evening. Welcome to the Conventional Sniper Podcast. I'm your spotter, Justin Clutty. Today is episode 11 on 30 November 2019. Welcome to the Conventional Sniper Podcast again. Let's go ahead and knock out the S2 brief. Just want to send a quick shout out to Short Action Precisions. I had a solo sack from them, which is one of their shooting bags. Essentially, it's filled with sand. It's supposed to be a heavier, tough bag. And I've broken two already in probably the past year and a half. And so I contacted those guys, said, hey, you know, I've got some improvement stuff, some ideas to help make your bag better. And I broke them. So they were kind enough to send me out a new solo sack. And I just want to say thanks to those guys. Thanks for their customer support. Thanks for responding back to my messages. They also make a two-round, individual round holder. And I just want to say thanks to those guys for that cool little product. It's like $6. Makes a great stocking stuffer for the year. If you're looking to get your favorite precision rifle shooter a little gift, I think it's like $6, I think. But I have one on the cover of my my podcast notebook where I write all my notes down, so I can hold my pens on the cover of my notebook without losing them all the time. So I can either put my 6.5 ammunition in there, or I can put my pens. So they just hold on with Velcro, and it works great. So thanks again to those guys. Also, I want to just give a quick shout out to whoever left the comment on the iTunes podcast page that did correct me on a situation which I knew that I was doing wrong, and I totally forgot to mention it. But I've mentioned before an O-give, which is the width of a bullet, and I want to correct myself and say it is the O-jive, Oscar-jive, but it's spelt G-I-V-E, but pronounced with a J instead of a G. So thank you for correcting me on that. I knew better. Sorry for being an idiot, but anyway, I digress. So also some breaking news, I guess you want to say. As you know, if you followed episode 10 when I was down at the sniper schoolhouse for the Army at Fort Benning, after talking with the Army Sniper Association, they have been gracious enough to allow me to be the official podcast for the International Sniper Competition coming up in April. So for the entire week of the competition, I will be there at the match, broadcasting recorded podcasts throughout the day, following, I don't know, a number of competitors throughout the day, following all the stages. It's going to be type of a ESPN, style of podcast where I'll be trying to spot all of the rounds and walking you through verbally through all the stages and trying to give you the best updated information as we go. And we're going to do it this way instead of with video, because there are some soldiers from not only the American Army but other militaries that need their faces concealed. So the podcast with the ASA, in conjunction with the ASA, is the best way for them to broadcast it and still remain, maintain some operational security. So, excuse me. So just want to say thank you to them. Thank you for Art. The president of the Army Sniper Association will also be doing some more podcasts with him coming up. The guy just has, he's got so much knowledge, and to have all that knowledge locked inside his head is kind of a, I don't want to say a crime, but it's a shame. So him and I talked more after the podcast, and we're going to continue to do some podcasts every time I go down there. Working on a call-in app so we can work with him over the phone. So if you have some suggestions or information on what's a good podcast app to do over the phone, please let me know. The app that I'm using probably isn't that great. I've tried a couple times and it just doesn't work for phone calls. So anyway, now let's get on to the podcast. So those of you that have been listening to the podcast in the past, I've promised that I will discuss the history of the technical, and I just want to take tonight to do the history of the technical. And I know where this podcast is designed for marksmanship and the craft of sniping, but it's kind of important to know some of these little cool tidbits of history, because as mechanized units are developing their doctrines and SOPs, especially with the invention of drones, it is imperative for mechanized type snipers to be able to keep up with mechanized units as they move. Now, there's some old Marine Corps manuals that discuss that, but some of the new manuals don't really have it, or at least not to my knowledge yet. I know it's still being developed in some areas. So I just wanted to cover this because it is interesting, because the American Army still uses a form of technicals, and that's with the Toyota Hilux. However, dating back to World War I, it's kind of the first example of a technical that's used. And a technical, for all intents and purposes, is a vehicle that is designed for utility. I say vehicle because World War I didn't really have vehicles. It's kind of a loose description. But designed for utility, such as a truck, that has been modified to carry an absorbent amount of troops and machine guns or rocket pods. In fact, when I was just kind of looking up the history earlier, I saw a picture of a Toyota Hilux that had been equipped with a Russian Hind helicopter missile pod on literally like a welded chassis. And they would put the Russian Hind missile, I guess the Sidewinder missiles or whatever, in, I guess they'd be like 2-inch rockets or something. They'd put them in the pods and then fire them off out of the back of the truck. Kind of like the old Nebelwerfers from World War II, or I guess a Frankenstein version of the Stalin organs, which is literally just a truck with a bunch of rocket pods on the back that fire off in the air, and it sounds like an organ going off. So the first example is the World War I Tachanka, which is literally a horse-drawn carriage with a Russian Maxim 1919 machine gun that the Russians used for hit-and-run tactics on the Eastern Front in World War I. Drive around with a bunch of horses with a machine gun on the back, belt feds, tearing it up, I guess. If you want to say tearing it up, but I guess you could say it had some good horsepower. So the next example that I could find, which would be the earliest American example, was during the Boston police riots in 1919, September 9th of 1919. And a little known fact that the 1st Corps of Cadets, which was originally a unit stood up to protect the provincial British governor just at the start of the Revolutionary War, they had eventually been stood up by Americans after, you know, obviously after the Revolutionary War was over, they became a different unit, but they were stood up to quell the Boston police riots. And during that time, they put Hotchkiss automatic rifle caliber 30 model 1909 on the back of their buggies so they could control the police riots. So as far as I'm aware, that is the first example of a technical in the United States military. And you don't see it too much until you really begin to see the Willys Jeep. Now, I would say that was just out of necessity. Hey, we need to put a machine gun on the back of this to control these nasty police officers. And, well, you could say that were on strike. They weren't really police officers because eventually they ended up getting fired. The governor at the time fired those police officers. So, I think it was just out of necessity that they needed some way to successfully maneuver that machine gun, that Kruser machine gun, around the battlefield. Well, it's not really a battlefield, but you get what I'm saying. So anyway, and then in World War II, you see the use of the Willys Jeep that's modified specifically by the British Royal Commandos, also known as the Desert Rats. They took Vickers 30 caliber machine guns and welded them and mounted them throughout the vehicle, fill it full of ammunition, food, water, gas, etc. And they would drive around and harass German convoys. So that's kind of like the last true example you see until you get into the 80s in Africa. And so you kind of have to back up a little bit and notice that one thing is it started with this whole thing kind of spiraled out of control in the 80s, starting in the 60s between Chad and Libya. And between Chad and Libya is the Azov Strip. And it went kind of back and forth for a few years. And essentially, Gaddafi, he basically wanted to own the Azov Strip. And essentially, fast forwarding to 1987, the Chadian president, Hassini Habré, and I apologize if I mispronounce it, I'm sure someone will correct me on iTunes here soon, essentially received 400 Toyota Hiluxes from the French, which is essentially like an assistance package. And those Toyota Hiluxes came armed, well, I shouldn't say armed, they came ready to be modified with machine guns and rockets and all that sort of stuff. And the French also supplied those arms. And it was to gain support to be able to attack into Libya and take back the Azov Strip in order to give it back to Chad. So essentially in 1987, the Chadians and rebel groups finally launch an assault. And they push into Libya, or they push up into northern Chad to take it back, and then back into the Azov Strip, and then eventually into Libya. But at first, they attack, I'm going to mispronounce this wrong, so bear with me here, Fada, which is essentially a major airstrip that's owned by the Libyans. It's got 2,000 troops at it. It's got tanks, artillery, and essentially the Chads attack with 5,000 troops, with all 400 of their Toyotas, and some French air support, and they essentially overrun this base. And they find out that they, in front of the Chadian air base, there's a minefield. And they find that with French air support pinning down the Libyan aircraft, that they can go up to 100 kilometers an hour and drive through the anti-tank minefield without setting the mines off. Now, I don't know about you guys, but there is no way in hell I'm jumping in a Toyota Hilux that's not up-armored and rolling through an anti-tank minefield. So if you could imagine, I'm sure the Chadians were doped up on everything that they could have possibly done. And some guy's like, dude, look, I'm telling you, when we're going to cross this, just floor it. If we get to the other side, great, we'll figure it out when we get there. So, you know, I got to hand it real sec for a second, like really hand it to these guys, that they just said, hey, we're just going to punch it, Mad Max style, figure it out when we get there. And that's kind of like the first example of when the Toyota Hilux gets its name in war. And I would say for the Middle East, even to some parts of Europe, which it's more or less the Land Rover, but I would say that's really when the Toyota Hilux specifically becomes more of the Willys Jeep of the Middle East. That's when they secure themselves the first utility vehicle for combat. Because the Willys Jeep was eventually modified with machine guns, and then eventually added recoilless rifles on there. And they've added mortar plates, and it can tow an ammunition trailer. And, you know, it's the predecessor to the Humvee, but, or vice versa. But you get what I'm saying. Like, it's pretty ballsy to run across anti-tank minefields with an up-armored truck and then modify it essentially to do everything you needed to do for the rest of the time. And it's quite interesting. But, so basically moving on from that is, fast forward basically into September of 2000, Chad decides they're fully going to move into Libya. So they take their original Toyota Hiluxes and they do a blackout movement into the backside of a Libyan airbase. And essentially, the Libyans are confused and they're thinking that, hey, there's a bunch of reinforcements coming. It turns out to be the Chadians. And they've got all the Toyota Hiluxes and they overrun this base. And they cause 1,700 Libyan casualties to only 65 of their own. And they basically wreck this base. And then they diddy mow out of there. So they proved the concept that light, I shouldn't say they proved it, they reinforced that the concept of light utility vehicles modified with machine guns can be used. And now there's something important to note about these vehicles is that they're cheaper to maintain, they don't cost as much, they can easily, you know, be repaired if they've been blown up. If they do get blown up, they're usually gone. But anyone with, you know, two hands and a brain can maintain this thing. It's super simple. The cost, especially the logistical cost of these vehicles, is super cheap. And it's important to note that, you know, everyone's kind of followed suit, but you don't really get the term technical until you look at Somalia in, you know, essentially the 90s and the 2000s, because non-governmental organizations were not allowed to hire their own private, they weren't allowed to bring in their own private security. So using technical assistance grants, they would hire local militias to protect them. And those local militias always had Toyota Hiluxes on them. In fact, during Black Hawk Down, Adid, the local warlord there, was actually carried to his grave in the bed of a Toyota pickup truck, Toyota Hilux. So that vehicle is synonymous essentially for everything Middle Eastern, you know, as far as rebels are concerned, and even in the northeast portion of Africa where you have just crazy Muslim militias running everywhere. So, especially in the 60s, using whatever they can, because after, you know, after the 50s, the 40s and 50s, Africa essentially falls apart and becomes utter chaos, especially in the northeast corner. So, you know, that's where you get the name from. And, you know, every military since then has used it. The SF in the United States military, they've modified Toyota pickups because, again, it's super cheap to use and maintain. Russia's taken a regular pickup truck, designed their own unique pickup truck to look like a Toyota Hilux, to act like a Toyota Hilux, be maintained like a Toyota Hilux, to be as efficient as a Toyota Hilux, just not be Toyota. You know? So even ISIS, or as they would like to be called, Daesh, even Daesh has used Toyota Hilux, and there's convoy after convoy after convoy of Daesh Toyota Hiluxes rolling down the street. And I'm sure that someone who ever worked at Toyota had no intention of the Toyota pickup truck being used as a vehicle of war. But sometimes that's what happens out of necessity, and that's how it rolls. So, you know, like I said, I just want to give you guys a quick down and dirty for the Toyota technical assistance package for the Middle East. But that's essentially how the Toyota works as far as it's concerned with being used in the Middle East. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed that portion. But I've got some other cool stuff coming up today. I went out to the range with another sniper friend of mine, and we took a Vietnam vet. And I have to say, I'm no Jocko Willink or Joe Rogan, but listening to some of the stories from these Vietnam vets, I think what we're going to do is we're going to reimagine the name of the Conventional Sniper Podcast. It's not going to be that I am a conventional sniper. I think what it is we're going to talk about everything conventional related, from the conventional infantryman to, the conventional police officer. We're going to talk about everything and everyone that we can, especially, I want to get a little bit more into the competitive side of things, maybe talk to some local guys. We'll get some more information on maybe some younger guys that are growing up in the conventional space shooting at precision rifle matches or precision pistol matches. I don't think it just has to be necessarily specifically sniping all the time, although that will be the main focus. I think there's a lot more to learn. I think especially learning from conventional guys, being on the receiving end of enemy sniper fire, super important to understand both aspects of it. And, talking to some other snipers that haven't really dove into the conventional precision rifle series or, precision rifle matches, there's a very big difference between the tactical precision rifleman and the practical precision rifleman. And a lot of local firearms clubs, especially in the Northeast, are very slow to catch on to the practical marksman. And if we look at what is the history of marksman, it's hitting the dot. And I think we've brought that up in like the first, either the first or second podcast. And hitting the mark is the purest form of marksmanship. Now, whatever the mark is, whether that be a steel plate or a piece of paper, it's still the original form of marksmanship, hitting the mark. And there's nothing in that original form of marksmanship that says I have to be prone, I have to be standing, sitting, kneeling. It just says I have to hit the mark. So if I'm running and gunning with a precision rifle from point A to point B to C to D in the least amount of time and the most efficient and consistent accuracy, that is marksmanship. That is hitting the mark. So if you're a club director out there and you're thinking that, we should only use known distances in slow fire CMP style matches, you're not following what true marksmanship is. You're modifying it to what you socially want. And that's unfair to every generation that's come before and every generation that's going to come after. And I think a lot of the things that these directors are missing is the word fun. These matches are fun, whether it be from the International Sniper Competition to the Civilian Marksmanship Program to the local NRL 22 matches to just holding a local match at your club to raise a few bucks in support of whatever, or just to open it for free to allow awareness and education. That's super important. And, I don't want you guys to think that I'm bashing on anyone, but in the Northeast, it's like there's some inbred concepts going on with that, and there's a lot of people that are blocking it. And I don't know if it's because they're getting older and they believe that iron sights are that they should only use iron sights on the range, but super important for younger generations to begin to learn this technology of optics. We're in the golden age of optics. They're changing constantly. It's important for you guys to study and learn all that stuff. So especially from the mathematical perspective, if someone had told me when I was in high school that I could learn math to shoot a gun, or even if there was a math class with guns, I probably would have paid attention 1,000 times more. I'd have been freaking hitting the nuke button at the Pentagon right now, because I would have studied math, and Mexico would have disappeared off the map. We would have gone down there and made it Texas 2.0. But anyway, I digress off of that topic. So, so coming up, we'll have some more sniper-related stuff in the next coming podcast. But I just said, like I said before, I wanted to catch up on the technical assistant package. I am working with will be sending an email to the First Corps of Cadets Museum in Boston to hopefully have the museum curator here on the podcast soon. the U.S. Army Corps of Cadets, First Corps Cadets, excuse me. It's a very interesting unit. Sam Adams, the flag that was draped over Sam Adams' coffin is on display there, as well as, to my knowledge, they were one of the first units to allow soldiers to compete in civilian marksmanship matches. And when I was at the museum, they had quite a bit of medals on display. So I've linked up with the museum curator. We're going to, you know, stay in contact, and we'll hopefully get her on the podcast and explain a lot of the marksmanship portions of that and the importance of it relating to civilian versus tactical and practical marksmanship. So anyway, I hope this is a short podcast. I hope you enjoyed your Thanksgiving. I hope your holidays go well, and we'll continue to push out some more podcast information. So thank you for coming on. And as always, from the tall grass, one shot, one kill. Thanks. Have a good night, guys.